Tanya Roelofse, and I'm the Honorary Secretary of SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I have a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next program talk will be a discussion on pensions freedoms given by Ian McKeever, which provides a different take on the problem of investment after retirement. This talk will take place on Tuesday, 4 December, and further details and online registration are available on SIAS's website. Unfortunately, tickets for our upcoming social events have booked out really quickly, but we will be releasing tickets for further events in the new year. Please keep an eye on our website and newsletters for further information. Next, a standard few notices about tonight's event. Tonight's event is hosted by SIAS, so we do encourage those of you that aren't currently SIAS members to join SIAS. Membership is extremely good value, £23 for IFOA fellows and £12 for IFOA students. Further details is also available on our website. There is an attendance sheet in the smaller room just outside the hall, which I don't think most of you signed on your way in, so please do sign it on your way out. Attendance at these talks does not get added automatically to your CPD record, so please remember to update your CPD in the normal way after the talk tonight. We're eager for our talks to run as smoothly and effectively as possible and would be delighted to hear any feedback you have. We will email you a short online survey after the talk. Please take a minute or two to complete this. We need your feedback to create the best possible experience for our members. Finally, remember to switch your mobile phones to silent. Tonight's talk will last around an hour, and if you have any questions, please raise your hand and a microphone will be brought to you. It will be a very interactive session, so I think there will be a lot of microphones being passed around. We value everyone's opinion at our talk, so there is a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to discussion by a student member of the IFOA, and another for the best contribution from any fellow. So please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before you ask your questions. Following the meeting, there will be sandwiches and networking drinks in the smaller room just outside the hall, so please join us. Back to tonight's talk. This talk will be an interactive discussion given by a panel of influential figures in the industry. Nick Riley joined the IFOA at the very end of the 20th century and has spent half of his career working in pricing and marketing roles at global reinsurers Swiss Re and SCOR, with the other half working in product development and pricing roles at insurers HSBC and Royal London. He is currently the lead actuary for Royal London's consumer division. Nick has been an IFOA volunteer for the past decade and is the current chair of the IFOA's Health and Care Board. So welcome, Nick. Hilary Salt is a founder of First Actuarial and combines national executive responsibilities in the business with running the Manchester office. Hilary's client work covers traditional actuarial consultancy and work with trade unions. She also provides policy advice to a number of organisations and is the independent actuarial advisor to the NHS Pension Scheme Scheme Advisory Board. Hilary is a member of the Council of the IFOA, and she has written a number of published articles and is a regular speaker at conferences. Last, but certainly not least, Michael Tripp, who is Head of Financial Services at Mazars. He was previously Group CEO at Ecclesiastical Insurance and before that a partner at both EY and Watson Wyatt, hopefully not at the same time, having spent his formative years with Guardian Royal Exchange. Michael is a prominent and long-standing figure in the UK general insurance industry with over 35 years of on-the-job experience and volunteering for the profession. He is currently an IFOA council member and was previously the chair of the General Insurance Board. Our speakers will kick off with some topic-based examples of things impacting the future of the actuarial profession, and I'll also read out a contribution by Ikki Igbal to the discussion. Ikki is a retired actuary and author who contributed enormously to generating ideas for this talk, but unfortunately he couldn't make it today. After these After this introduction, I'll then put questions to the floor and encourage you to join us debating some of the most prominent challenges facing actuaries moving forwards and how we may need to adapt to tackle these. On that note, Hilary, do you want to kick off?
Thank you. Thanks very much. And thank you, colleagues, for turning out. I like to stand behind the lectern. It's very high, this lectern, so I have to stand on my tiptoes now. So I know I'm here to talk primarily about pensions, but I did just want to start off making a few points about the role of experts and professionals. And you might remember that a kind of defining moment in the run-up to the Brexit referendum was Michael Gove expressing the view that we're fed up of experts. And the degree of opprobrium heaped upon him for saying that was really telling. And of course, it is obvious on one level that we do need a surgeon to remove our appendix and an actuary to value our pension fund. But I do think he was actually onto something. Because I would argue that today that the professional and political elites in the UK are the most short-term focused and risk-averse elites in the UK ever. That's a bold statement. But I would argue that they're so dominated by a fear of the future that they privilege stability over anything else. And for a kind of fearful elite that is scared like that, contracting out decisions to experts, professionally supranational experts who know an evidence-based truth and therefore know what's best for us, know how we should behave, that's inherently appealing to such a fearful elite. So for them, expertise means technical managerialism, where nothing is disputed, where answers are uncontested. And in that world, that old catechism that I believe in one God, the Father Almighty, becomes, I believe that global warming means we need to reduce consumption. I believe in the usefulness of gender pay gap figures, and I believe in the need to buy more bonds. And of course, for an elite that's fearful in the way that I've described, the questioning of any of those things is unthinkable. But I'd argue really strongly that society needs experts to disagree. Innovation and progress require disagreement, contestation, experimentation, and yes, sometimes failure. And professionals need to take responsibility for upholding and advancing their craft. And for us, to drive our craft forwards and expertise forward, we need to practice it in the public arena. And we need to use it to solve real human needs and problems. So put simply, in my area, in pensions, we need to find a way to provide pensions, to provide an income in retirement that ordinary workers need. And it's shocking to me that the pensions industry is currently saying we cannot provide pensions. DC schemes into which most people are being auto-enrolled today don't provide a pension at all. It's just a lump sum that's very hard to convert efficiently into a wage in retirement. The potentially efficient DB schemes we have are being run at maximum inefficiency. They're closed, so there's no fungibility bonus. They're doing as they're told by the regulator, moving into the lowest yielding assets and guarantee a negative real rate of return. So what we've done in doing all that is created a crisis in public confidence in pensions. And we've done that at a time when we're kind of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, when pensions are better protected than they've ever been. And we've created a headache for employers who are dealing with a two- or three-tier workforce. They can't keep staff. They can't allow staff to retire with any dignity. But, and I'm very conscious that I did promise today I wouldn't be doom and gloom. I would try to bring some good news stories as well, because I actually think there are now some real green shoots emerging from the scorched earth policy that has been the professional practice of pensions recently. So many of you have seen the dispute between the academics and universities over the industry-wide pension scheme USS. That dispute and the joint expert panel set up as part of the resolution to it have kind of dragged actuarial methods into the public arena and fostered a really widespread public debate and contestation.
And it's another dispute, the one between the Communication Workers Union and Royal Mail, that's forced us to confront a really difficult problem and find a solution to it. And if I can kind of caricature that problem, it was broadly that, you know, the workers were saying, we need an income in retirement, DC won't do, we will not have it. The employer was saying, not unreasonably, we can't manage the accounting impact or the inefficient investment strategy and subsequent inflated cost of providing DB. So that was an opportunity for actuaries to step forward and to say, we can design a scheme that provides a non-guaranteed income in retirement at an efficient cost, but doesn't have the same accounting impacts as traditional DB. And that design, collective DC, is theoretically possible, but not legislatively permissible. And that kind of gave a real opportunity for everybody, all the stakeholders there, to say, let's lobby government for change and let's make it work. And that's what we did. And I'm just really proud and delighted to be here tonight on the day that government launched their consultation to introduce Collective DC. So those are great examples, I think, of the fact that satisfying human need is the fountainhead of expertise. And our expertise, our professionalism, can only be legitimised by the extent to which it solves real problems attached to real human beings in the real world. And contrary to all that arrogant elite view of experts as disinterested neutral arbiters, real experts, real professionals, are forged in that white heat of solving problems in the real world. And I know we've got some younger colleagues here tonight, and I'm really, really confident that as our next generation of actuaries, you're going to be ready and able to go out there and solve some problems. Thank you.
Thanks, Hilary. That was good food for thought. Nick, tough act to follow.
I'll see what I can do. Evening, everyone. I'll start with the reason why I'm here. So at the start of the year, I was down in Brighton for the health and care conference. And, it was very early, late in the morning or early in the morning, however you want to say it. We were having the last drinks in the round before we got kicked out the bar. And an actor who I didn't know, who'd been sitting on the table listening to our conversation, just turned out with a statement and just said, you're not proud to be an actuary, are you? Which I thought, well, you know. So I said, why is that? And he said, well, you know, you're dumbing us down. You know, you're saying that, you know, you're saying these things that are against actuaries. And I was like, well, not really. I said, I've been a member of the profession for just under 20 years. So qualified for, say, I don't know, 12, 13 of those years. Majority of that I've been volunteering one way or another. So given how long it took me to qualify, and it was pretty hard graft to get there, and then adding stuff back since then, literally from day one, of course I'm proud to be an actuary, but I was interested to know why. And it was all about the conversation about how our roles moved, because I hear too often, in my view, that we're data. We love data. It's a bit like Hilary was saying, and I'll get onto it in a minute. You know, data drives us. You know, we're great at analysing data. That's what actuaries do. What do? Well, we get data and we manipulate it and we put it into a model, and great. And there's a conversation about that, and you know, there's been a lot of conversations I've been hearing about, and I know it's been going at high levels, should we be more data scientists? Should we bring data scientists into us? Should we be the experts in that field? And the gist of the conversation, which is what got this actuary to say his point, was I said, no, I think 100% we shouldn't be. We should let people who don't have to do the exams that we do, who aren't paid what we have to do to compensate for that, who are probably, let's be honest, cleverer and brighter than us at data manipulation or coding or all the kind of things that we're not trained to do and probably our mindset isn't right. Let people do that. They are the experts on it. Let them do some data analysis. What our USP is, in my view, and we're missing the point, is being given that information and understanding what it means, applying it, and it's quite recent, for those that don't know the communication exam, communicating it. Now, I don't think our education necessarily backs us up for that. I think it's slowly moved in. I think we're lucky if we can communicate like that because we've learnt it from others who are good at it or have got that bias. But I don't believe as a profession we have been set up that way. And I think when you look at our exams, it's no real different to when I did it. and it isn't a million miles different to when people did it 30 years ago or 40 years ago. And I talked to people who are still working, but they were saying they started doing commutation tables and doing premiums then. So go from that world to, even when I started, I was given a computer to myself, and it was about a big decision, apparently, for the company to do a whole computer per person. Nowadays, we have all the power in our hand, and we can run millions of scenarios, yet our exams and our thinking since that period's been in is that we've tweaked the early ones a bit. The later ones are still about the same. We've added a couple of new topics because let's talk about health a bit more than with-profit funds. And we talk about communication, that, you know, doing one exam on writing an essay or doing a presentation isn't what the value I get and why people now hire me is for. I'm now treating myself and hopefully, you know, will happily say that I'm a commercial actuary. When people explain what you do, I say, I'm not a valuation actuary. I'm not a numbers person. I'm a commercial actuary. Someone will ask me what something is. I say, oh, that's, I'll know the numbers. I know how it works. I won't want to do the numbers, and I won't want to present numbers. I'll put them in as part. My aim is to say, here are some numbers, and that is what it means, and that is what I recommend. And I think it goes back to what Hillary said, which was fortunate because we swapped orders. It's that expert judgment part. What you get for a peer review, the value you add for the knowledge you've got. Now, it's very hard to teach that kind of commerciality. It's very hard to teach how to do a peer review, how to understand the mechanics of it. I think a lot of actuaries have it. I think a lot of actuaries could miss it because they don't want to do it, or it becomes a bit too hard, or it's not in their mindset. But I think, and from the conversation of that, that I don't think it's too late. I don't think it's too late for us to try and take on the data to understand it and to apply that, but I think it's about time we start future-proofing our profession, because we don't have 200 actuarial students sitting doing commutation functions to do life premiums like it used to be, and we don't have, when I started, 10 or 12 students running quotes in a reinsurer. When you're running the different systems on Moses, you've now got 3 people doing it. So there's this finite amount where we will need less students but going forward, but we could probably increase that if we had wider areas to do it. And I think that's where commerciality, rather than just pure data and number crunching, is where our USP could, and in my view, should lie. So that's me. Thank you.
Michael.
Good evening. How are we all? You're going to have to warm up, because we really do want this to be interactive. Otherwise, we'll all go to the pub much too soon, which is not good for our longevity, I suspect, Hilary and Nick. It seems a long time ago, does 1970, and I actually don't feel as old as that might imply. I actually feel like I'm still 19 and I think full of life and energy. But in 1970, I was at a careers evening, and somebody said, well, you're not bad at maths, Michael. Have you ever heard of what it is to be an actuary? And one thing led to another, and I learned at that stage that the exams, it was challenging to become a fellow. And I always liked to rise to a challenge. It was a small profession, so you get to know people, and there's that intimacy and sharing insights. And that you didn't have to be technical. You could use the exams to understand how businesses worked and actually, get involved in running them. And as I look back on my life, I'm pleased that that's what's happened, by accident or design. And I think if we are trying to talk about 20 years, say, into the future, to get your views on how that's going to apply will be really, really interesting and useful, particularly to Hillary and myself on council, but to all of us, because it's our lives and our legacies. Trying to define the kernel of what the word actuarial or actuarial science means just isn't easy. And I don't think we've done very well collectively over certainly the last 50 years, probably since Reddington or something like that, for those that like history. I've written down here a whole list of words, and I'll just run through them very quickly. Risk, the quantification of risk, the management of risk, financial insights, economics, mathematics, analytics, long-term thinking. That I used to say a little time ago is one of our unique attributes, the time value of money. It may not be, what do they call commutation functions? I've almost forgotten it so long ago since I did BT, two. Nobody will know that. Longevity, mortality, the professionalism, the ethics, the public good. You know, these are all attributes. The insights into the businesses of insurance, life assurance, pensions, health insurance, investments and so on. Increasingly, artificial intelligence, data science. We want to have the best techniques that there are and to be imaginative about how to apply them for the sort of things that Hillary's been talking about and Nick. Customer data. Yes, you get into valuations, financing, and we mustn't forget that a lot of people do play a regulatory role because we are trusted. So there's a long, long list, and I'm not sure we've got the kernel of what makes us unique, but somewhere in that list that there may be an element of something to think about. You can tell that I don't write these things up. I just sort of have scribbles and hope to add. The third area that I put down were sort of the new areas. I mean, as an old fogey, and probably I'm in a blue suit and white, grey, male, and all of that, so I do apologise. I can't change that. Or maybe you can these days. but I'm lucky enough to be involved with the data science working group that the council's got, and you know, there's been working parties and so on. And that's brought me into contact with the Royal Statistical Society. I never thought I'd ever have contact with the Royal Statistical Society, so life is full of adventure. But, you know, we've done workshops, and now we're working on how can we combine the expertise from the Royal Statistical Society with the business insights from us as professional actuaries. Artificial intelligence, AI, is a much-used, overhyped word. But there is the singularity. Who here has heard of the Singularity University? I would really, really, really recommend you go away and Google it and have a look at who. If I said, can somebody tell me what the singularity is? Who would be brave enough to do that? So there are some. No, I'm not making you do it now. We might come back to that. In essence, it's about the power of computing. I'm going to get this wrong. It's about the way that computers will work, and at the moment at which their ability to do things that human beings will do will actually intersect. I'll get corrected later if I've not got that definition quite right. But it's, look at the Singularity University. Look at what they're talking about in the futuristic stuff, and think about what does that mean for us as professionals. I think, as has already been said, we're really the unique bits about the. If you're talking to the Royal Statistical Society, they know about maths and maybe artificial intelligence is a reinvention of Bayesian statistics. Who knows? But our contribution is about defining the problem, interpreting the results. It's about communication, informing, and helping to make decisions. I think that's a common theme between us. But why aren't we working for Google and Amazon? Why aren't we working for British Airways or Air France? Why aren't we working for Boeing? I mean, banks should be trivial. We should, as head of financial services, I've got an oversight into banking. But, there are some very natural things. But I think we need to think much more broader and much more adventurously, which leads me on to the last point you'll be pleased to know. The world is changing, Singularity University or not. The world is changing unbelievably fast. We are supposedly living through the fourth industrial revolution. And I think if we want, which I don't know, I do. I just love what I've had the experience of the last N years from the actuarial world, where N is a large number, too large. And tending to infinity, can I say that? No, I don't think it's going to be that long, is it? But the world is changing so fast, and I would love to see our profession adapt and evolve. And I think that's a real challenge for us, because we're balancing this sort of caution and this ability to not make mistakes and not get things wrong versus the need to evolve, adapt, and I think the word might be pioneer, commercially pioneer. That's probably what I would love to see us do. And that might mean, I stood here once, probably 10 years ago, it might be longer ago, talking about operational risk and the quantification of operational risk in general insurance. And I seem to remember saying completely madly, why do we only recruit mathematicians? Now, I know that's not quite true, but it's probably 95% true. And then you go, oh, yeah, but we should recruit data scientists. Yes, of course we should recruit data scientists. Yes, of course we should recruit analytics. But why don't we recruit PPE graduates? Why don't we recruit psychologists? Why don't we recruit storytellers that could actually help us tell our stories and communicate? Why do we just have one route to fellowship? You know, why can't we be more adaptive and actually involve people and have that diversity in many, many ways that would help us be here in 20 years' time? That's my input.
Perfect, thank you. I'm just quickly going to read out, summarise Icky's paper. For those of you who'd like more information or would like to see the paper in full, we'll provide more details online of how you can do that, so please do have a look online after the talk today. So Icky was very keen to have a discussion on the future of the actuarial profession, and he has written a paper, and like I've said, I've just brought some thoughts together. Icky's paper refers to the following concepts. He accepts that whilst we learn from the past, we must focus on the future, but also suggests that we need to know where we went wrong. One of the challenges referred to in his paper includes how to break away from being a number cruncher, which can lead to actuaries finding it difficult to move into wider management roles. This is also important with the uncertainty, we've also had our panel members refer to regarding future roles of humans in society in general, as a vast amount of what we previously regarded as highly complex technical work can and will be done in the future by clever computers. He then further goes on to raise some thought-provoking questions on whether the appropriate IFOA governance structure is in place and whether there is enough focus on the UK actuarial market with a recent perceived growth in the overseas market. Icky then suggests creating a role requiring a wide range of skills suitable for senior management. He acknowledges that the two key skills required would be a total command of communication skills and the ability to think long term. He finishes with the words, "I can't think of any other profession that is better equipped to deal with the long-term issues than actuaries. It is easier for actuaries to improve their communication skills than for others to compete with actuaries on long-term planning. A new future awaits the profession." Right, on that note, I think what we'll do, we've got a few questions that I'd like to get through tonight and then just hear your thoughts on those questions. I'll start focusing on the past and those kind of things and then move towards the future. So the questions really start off with, as a profession, where have we gone wrong in the past and what have we learned from our mistakes? Really, how do we ensure we don't make the same mistakes over? Over to you. If you raise your hand, we'll bring a microphone to you. And remember, there is lots of champagne on offer, a whole two bottles.
Hello, it's Chris O'Brien. Where have we gone wrong in the past? Then Icky refers in his paper to the problems regarding with-profits business and defined benefits pension schemes, the decline in which he regards as being not good news for the profession because we've been closely associated with those products. I'd also like to add one thing that Icky, who was the person who actually suggested this type of meeting originally, appreciated the help of Marjorie Nguyenga as former president in being positive about setting it up. My own view is that, yeah, there have been problems, and each generation, I hope, does better than the previous generation. When I started as a life actuary in the 1970s, we didn't do asset shares and EBITDA values, but in the 1980s, we did those things. And whilst I agree that artificial intelligence can take over many of the routine jobs that we have, I think it's the changes in momentum whereby we do something completely different, where we rely upon actuaries to think, yeah, we do need embedded values, which weren't done in the past. A computer's not going to say, we want something completely different. There will be a Solvency III sometime. I don't think it'll be a computer that develops it. It will be actuaries who are involved in developing it. We need innovative people. We need research. And I agree with Hillary, we need research that provokes discussion and disagreement where disagreement is needed. I think that we have a British Actuarial Journal, which is a journal of practitioner research, which is very valuable. Such journals in the US and Australia have disappeared early this century. So let us keep our programme of sessional meetings. I think maybe we could encourage people to attend by maybe announcing them a bit differently, but get people along doing research and presenting research. That's a way to move the profession forward. But there's another step which I believe is also very important. We've actually got to take notice of that research and apply it. If you look back at some research that has examined aspects of with-profits business and defined benefit pensions, research was there saying what needed to be done, but we didn't do it, or it took too long to do it. Sometimes research produces suggestions that says we need to do things different, which may be things that we don't want to do differently. But we need to grasp the nettle and take those things on board. And a sessional paper almost exactly 12 months ago talked about the way that we communicate to members the financial strength of defined benefit pension schemes, saying what we do at the moment is just not right. That message has been said for many years. I haven't seen any disagreement with it. Maybe there should be disagreement with it. But we need to pick up on these messages, and sometimes they're not very comfortable messages, but if we ignore them, then things will go wrong. Maybe just a thought, because I was intrigued by a number of things that Hilary said. It's difficult to persuade employers to provide salary-related pensions. Should we have state earnings-related pensions? Because clearly, that's what employees need. They need earnings-related pensions, and not cash sums. I wonder whether that's something that, if the market for defined benefit pension schemes no longer exists in the way that we might ideally want it to provide that, is that a market failure where the state should step in? I don't know.
Thanks, Chris.
Ian McKeever, I think the great mistake of the actuarial profession in the past has been that we've not actually defended the things that we do provide. We have not actually entered into discussion about with profits and final salary pension schemes and said, well, yes, there's a problem. How should we deal with the problem and amend the nature of these things to make them more practical and deal with the problem? But what has tended to happen is that there's been more and more regulation, there's been more and more anti-with-profits, anti-final salary pension scheme, that we have actually allowed these two very useful services to the population in general to wither. You know, we have just not defended the good bits, because generally there have been good bits, and there's been a lot of a lot of people have said, well, there's this wrong with it and there's that wrong with it, and that has taken over the whole discussion. I just think we need to defend what we do in a much more public arena and not sit here talking to each other about how good they are.
And I think that really comes back to actuaries communicating better. And I think a lot of the time what we're really good at is just, sitting at our desks and getting on with our work, as opposed to going and talking about how good our work is. Any thoughts from the panel?
Can I say a couple of things that have been kind of raised from the floor? So I agree that state provision and state pension provision, is the obvious candidate to replace
the kind of broken pension system we've got at the moment. And clearly, within the public service arena, the government is still a big provider of occupational pensions. I've argued on more than one occasion that the ideal solution would be to open up public service pensions to everybody, because that would be a much more efficient way of providing pensions than the really inefficient DC individual schemes we have at the moment. But so I think that kind of brings it round to the points that you were raising, because I think in a lot of things that we do as a profession, we are swimming against the tide of current society. So the things that we're good at are collective provision, looking at things in the round for a group of people. There's a lot of, you know, individualistic politics out there these days. People don't want to be part of a collective. People want to be part of a tiny, more and more divisive identity politics. We're good at the long term. But, you know, out there, short term is king. It's really hard to argue for anything long term. I don't think that means we should abandon any of those things that we're good at. We do, as you said, we need to be out there arguing for those kind of things in the public arena. And it's really interesting. This is not just about actuarial science. So, you know, the public intellectual doesn't exist anymore. And that's a real loss for society. So, you know, the public intellectual we used to have, who might be out there talking to ordinary people and going out there doing lectures in the regions, those kind of people hardly exist anymore. In fact, those intellectual elites just pour scorn and disdain on the grey, unwashed, stupid, hoodwinked, Brexit-voting proletariat. You know, and that's not a thing that we've produced. That's a much wider social thing. And I think lots of the values we have are values that society really needs, and we should be arguing really strongly for.
Who are really thirsty, or just pension actuaries in the room. Hand at the back over there, Andrew.
Thank you. Stephen Rees, fellow. I thought a number of Hillary's comments have been really unhelpful, because I think I agree with them all. And if we're trying to generate some debate, then that doesn't really do it. Apart from the slight misquote of Michael Gove, which has been widely done, that the whole quote is never repeated, because that's not quite as interesting. Whether we have some sort of an elite, I'm not quite sure what it is, but we have got some sort of political thing that is obsessed by short-termism and being risk-averse. And for a little while, I think we have played along with that, and that's been a bit unhelpful. To some extent, we've just been going with the flow because that's what we thought everybody wanted. To some extent, it's because we were getting beaten up by Morris and that review, and that was pretty unhelpful when we should have stood up for ourselves better. And one of the problems is we are really good at risk measurement without necessarily being good at risk management, and that's an unhelpful attribute. And I think we need to understand the difference between those better. Over the years, we should have defended things like defined benefit pension schemes and with-profits funds because they were really, really good ideas. And it's a disappointment to society that we don't have those anymore. And we should have defended them better. We should have been more outspoken in that, because I think we get more impact than we realise when the profession speaks on matters where we've got some consensus at least. A lot of other entities, powerful entities, do take notice, and we really underuse that power and influence that we could be having. And I would love for us to extol the virtues of collectivism and pooling of risk, because they are really, really valuable things to society. And I think we've almost done a disservice to society by not standing up for those better and explaining why we're really good at some of this stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, I thought I'd do something slightly different from pensions just for a second, but to do a view about the short-term versus long-term. So there's a topical area at the moment. I assume people understand and know what I mean, but, you know, we've got e-cigarettes at the moment. So we're looking at impact of e-cigarettes under health and care on what that would do to your morbidity, possibly mortality, what theoretically that should do for kind of rating factors. And, you know, we've also got a social aspect on it. Because, you know, you get front pages on The Sun or things saying insurers believe smoking is the same as e-cigarettes, because currently we have in our question set, are you a smoker, it includes e-cigarettes. There have been studies which are called long-term studies if you're in that field, which are about a year, which obviously we don't call that a long-term study. But we're currently having to fight through this part of saying when we look at the analysis and the data, we've got a working party on it. You know, 98% of the harmful things or more aren't in e-cigarettes, but there could be 1% of stuff that could be new that isn't in there. I've had conversations to say to the profession to say, do we go out, you know, early, and I'm talking 20 years early compared to normal, and actually come out with a statement to say e-cigarettes appear less harmful than cigarettes on what we've seen? But I've even had, no, it's far too early, we need to wait another 10, 20 years to find out. In 10 or 20 years' time, I can guarantee there won't be the e-cigarettes we're having now. You know, it was a massive change before my time to say, do you know what, I think smoking and non-smoking may be different. Let's wait another 20 years and see if it is. We can't do that now. So there is there's a view for me to actually try and say, look, when do we come out early? How do we put this information out there? If you don't and someone reads something, they may misinterpret it completely. Do we take this data? There are experts out there who are putting it out. Do we look at it and say, do you know what, balance of probability, it looks like it's less bad. Don't say it's good for you, you say it's less bad for you. Then you can make decisions about what you do for pricing, reserving, all the stuff we do best. It puts that into our agenda. If you don't have this conversation, there are probably people sitting there saying, currently in my Solvency II IPMAP submission, I don't have anything about e-cigarettes, and it'll take me a year and a half to make a change to change that, so I don't want to talk about it because I've just got it in. So the common sense part of we need to be looking at this is worrying me, what do we do? Are we directing people to carry on smoking because we're not giving them a reduction on their premium? Are we being driven by the simplicity of just leaving the Solvency II basis as it is, or let's wait another 5 years, 10 years, let's not rush things? My view is the world's going so fast, we need to change our way of what's called rushing versus what's called actually having a response. And it's an interesting one we're doing. You can pretty much guess what side of the fence I'm on, but I thought I'd throw that one out there. There are topical bits that we're discussing now that involve this.
That's a really good comment. Michael, do you have anything on that?
Are we still talking about lessons learned, or are we...
We'll finish off on lessons learned.
Maybe move on to the next question.
Yeah. Okay. My lesson learned was don't wait another 25 years. Sorry, that was the link
If I was going to say anything, I'd get myself into trouble. Like, why are we using words like pension still? Aren't they old-fashioned? That's not to say, I obviously do believe that we have a role in helping people provide for themselves throughout life. But it's, you know, 100-year life, how many careers will people have? Will they be working, you know, 85 to 95, and therefore they'll need their pension when they're 25, if pension is the right word?
Right. On that note, we'll move on to question
number two. They'll hit me afterwards.
So question number two is about how we balance professionalism, and that includes trust and reliability with a need to evolve, adapt, and experiment. A good example, I think, of this is for actuaries working outside of the usual compliance and regulation, like reserving work and that kind of thing, of course needs to be TAS compliant, and it's easy to make it TAS compliant because you've just got actuaries around you. But what if you are advising a company on, say, their operations or something like that? How do you deal with that? Any thoughts from the audience?
Me again, Ian McKeever. I just don't see that the profession seems to recognise that there is this conflict between the thing that the profession is becoming is increasingly involved in, which is regulation, and the introduction of new ideas, because regulation is actually going to necessarily restrict innovation. And I think as a profession we need to look at where one strikes the balance between regulation and innovation, because we're talking about innovation, but the profession itself is heavily involved in producing more and more regulation and restricting what we do and how we do it.
We've got someone just behind you over there.
Thank you. My name is David Simmons. Professionalism means many different things to many different people. So an interpretation I'll take for this comment is that a key element of professionalism is serving the public interest. And I think a future role for our profession, who have, I feel, an aptitude for getting into the detail and really understanding the issues, is serving the public interest in the day, in the modern era of the all-powerful computer, which I see as serving the big corporation for the detriment of the little guy. And I can see this being a bigger problem as we move into the areas of what we call artificial intelligence, but really it is human intelligence programmed into a computer. But the danger there is that this sometimes complicated intelligence gets programmed into the computer and we lose all the controls of what was done, and suddenly it's the computer says, and no one knows why the computer said it, because the human that put it in there has long since left the scene. And I think a role for us is to be the profession that explains what is going on to the general public, to actually make people actually be transparent in what they do and make people aware that some of the big innovations using powerful computers, and I'm thinking things like, say, the online banking and the mass use of the internet, wasn't actually invented by Joe Public, who wanted a service, but actually was invented by the big corporation who wanted to provide that service more cheaply. And I'll leave with one example, which I heard on the radio a few weeks ago, was in the, I think it was a health or medical expense insurance claim over in the US, when a perfectly valid claim was for quite a large sum, which was important to the policyholder, was rejected because the computer algorithm said this claim is invalid. Well, after much, much, much effort by the people involved, they actually did get the issue resolved and the claim was in fact valid. And I think we should be there. And coming back to Mike, I think that a skill actually is needed is data science. We need to understand what is actually going on in that space. And so I'll sum up by saying that we want to focus on the public interest.
Excellent, thank you. On that note, how do we get the profession to help support innovation for us as actuaries? Anyone have any thoughts? Oh, we've got someone at the back there,
Andrew. I'll make a point that's related to your previous question and this one, perhaps. Katie Hicks, I'm a student, just to put me in the running. I actually think that the profession is very, very good at providing support in the traditional and newly traditional areas that actuaries work in. And And that is partially to do with what employers are looking for. Employers are looking for actuaries in those areas. However, when people do end up in other non-traditional areas, and maybe much more non-traditional, like Boeing was suggested, or Google, there's no specific guidance from the past that would cover what they are doing. And so, yes, they very much have to go on their own and decide, what does professionalism mean for me here? But I think first they have to decide, what actuarial skills am I using here? And then it's working with the profession to say, all right, I'm using these skills. Some of them are very actuarial, some of them are not so actuarial. I think this is the way to do it. And then they're going to be the first one. So I think the profession is going to be, or hopefully will be, more responsive than like reactive rather than proactive in those cases, which is kind of sad, but...
good feedback. So really we've heard a lot about helping support innovation and helping support wider fields, and how does the IFOA support us doing that. Moving on to the next question, what weight would we put on industry experience compared to more generic or maybe leading edge techniques? And I think we've covered it slightly already, and really what we're trying to get at is, I think your question and statement and challenge summarizes it quite well. We know a lot about life, GI and pensions, and not so much about different fields and wider fields, and how do we forge actuaries of the future? Anyone else have a comment on that?
Why don't you throw in all the questions, given time, and then see what kind of responses you get? Because then,
okay. The last two questions that we have is on what types of organisations will employ actuaries 5 to 10 years from now, which leads on nicely, and what does that mean for our qualification structure and skill set? So really, guys, if you've got comments on that, good. If you have other questions for the panel or anything like that that you think is important for the future of the actuarial profession, that's good too. So do get involved. We've got a question over there.
Bryn Davis is the name. I'm really just asking a question, but there's this unquestioned attitude that wider fields are something good. Now, maybe that was the mistake. Maybe we should have stuck closer to our core competencies. And part of the problem is, well, Michael struck a chord with me when he mentioned when we joined the profession, you could know everybody. There were less than 1,000 practicing actuaries in the UK. Now the number now is 20 or something. It's a different profession in many ways. And I sometimes think that this talk about wider fields is a sort of, it's treating the profession as the thing rather than what actuaries do. And maybe that's just the wrong way around, and perhaps there's just too many actuaries. Perhaps that's the problem.
And we've got another question over there,
Antri.
Yep.
Yeah, hi, my name is Ian. And a quick question to Hilary. In an age of innovation, how are we able to overcome, you know, what you call legislative permissibility? If you think about it, when actuaries get it wrong, you know, the effects usually tend to be very catastrophic and very big. And how do you gain back the trust of the public to actually believe in us and believe in, you know, what we're doing is for the common good, especially when, you know, we're in an age where, you know, policymakers not necessarily be this, you know, the wisest person in the room. If you think about US policy and the people who are, you know, governing their foreign policy and things like that, how do we as actuaries, you know, come back and be what you were calling a public intellectual? And a quick comment for the issues you raised about regulation and innovation. I think luckily for the institute and the profession, we as young people and student actuaries who are joining the, you know, the profession now, we're fortunate enough to understand the repercussions of when things go wrong. So we do understand why we do need all the regulation and everything else. And we're also fortunate enough to live and be born in an era of quite a lot of tremendous change and innovation. So we've been here since Amazon started, and you know, we've been here, we've seen how much value companies like Facebook and all that have added. And you know, if we are able as actuaries to innovate products that are both regulatory compliant and also, you know, they're innovative and they're making things and people's lives better, I think we'll be better off. Thank you.
Does anyone else have any comments? We've got a comment from Katie again over there. Andrew?
Okay. Oh, yep. I just wanted to ask a question. How do you balance the benefits of collectivism with what is going to, I think, increasingly become the trend towards in insurance accurate, in inverted commas, pricing through big data, AI, etc.?
I mean, I'll just say a separate point on that one. In do we have a moral role in not allowing data to get too far to be individually pricing, given that it will then mean that certain individuals, it becomes unaffordable or they become uninsured? That's a professional comment that we've had. As we move closer, I've seen enough presentations where everyone says it's the insurance pricing of one, this is the risk for you. That's probably the person who doesn't need the insurance. It's probably the other ones that you're not sure about, and now you've priced them out. So I've had quite a few interesting debates on that. Fortunately, I don't think we're quite there yet, so you know, it'll take quite a while, but I think that's a moral decision later on for people. But there's probably a way where we should refine. My example, you know, try and classify by risk, for example, you know, just one giant smoker. What about ex-smokers? What about e-cigarettes? You know, that should be within our gift to do that at a broad level. But I do worry that if in 10, 20 years' time you can work out the mortality rates of people and you charge accordingly, you will end up doing exactly what insurance, the opposite of what insurance was set up for in the first place.
Any further comments?
I mean, I'm not sure they're mutually exclusive, are they? You can have collectivism with some form of risk-based pricing. I mean, you know, probably in a few years' time, instead of going for a blood test, you'll go for a DNA test or something, and there will be even more insights, won't there, on the longevity, whether it, you know. So the question is it, but it's one, isn't it, that we as actuaries should help inform public debate? It's not our decision, I don't think. I mean, maybe there'd be different views on that. And maybe there's too much on our shoulders at the moment, but we certainly are well placed to inform public debate, and it's not necessarily about collectivism versus individual pricing. It's sort of trying to get the right balance.
Yeah, no, I think that's what I was hopefully trying to say as well. By the fact, yeah. I think we've got further to go where we can do fairer pricing. There will be a point that you then moving into the uninsurability, which you know you have to a degree already, but it's quite clear. But it's that the hidden bits, which is why you know we've got so many different bits on the genetics moratoriums talked about. In detail, the fact that individuals can get their own genetic tests, even though we all know, if you've looked at it, it's pretty rubbish at the moment. But as that technology moves in, we also have the issue that, you know, how far behind the times would an insurance industry go? Because, you know, it doesn't takes a year or two if you haven't changed a moratorium, but everyone could select against you for the insurance industry to then have found they've got a big problem. So not only do we need to be on the front foot for the way technology and the way things are moving, is it our bit for that to be that moral compass? Probably to a degree, but yeah, not on our own. But there's a point where we keep going until we...
It's also like somebody said about we're good at risk measurement, not necessarily risk management. You know, if you take the young driver issue, which is maybe in the general insurance world, but the fact that young drivers' risk prices, I don't know, 10 times an older person... then leads you into, so why is that and what can we do about it? And if it's a problem for society, then what are our ideas about how to improve things?
Yeah, no.
Which we're in violent agreement.
Yeah,
I think.
Exactly. Yeah, it then moves into what do you do about the insurable bit? Well, actually, if it's not an insurance company, should it be the state? What do we do? So there are, but it widens the whole point, and technology and understanding is literally the, what's pushing us there.
We've got someone that's hand has been up long over there. So if you go first, and then we'll come back to you.
Hello?
Yep.
Hi, Ciro. Ciro Giaquinto. Just, I have a question a little bit more technical. I believe, for example, 20, 30 years ago, the triangles or the now traditional methods we use in our discipline were not traditional. And now they are traditional. Now it's coming data science, and everyone is scared what happened now to actuaries. I think we should take an approach of validating, because data science is not interested to what actually these methods do. The goal is something that is different from us. We rather than learning to use them, because we can learn quite easily, is about to validate them. What are the limitations of this? What do we need to be careful of? This the profession needs to take, must really identify and innovate. For example, in reserving, Marco Chain Monte Carlo simulation, why the profession still has not validated this method? They say yes and determine the limitations, so actually use it rather than still be in the cloud. We don't know what actually these methods are. Here, I think the profession needs to be on the front line. Thank you.
Good contribution, and we've got another one over there.
So I want to come back to my public interest point and the point you were discussing just before about how we use all this data, individual pricing. And I think where we should be pointing out is that, yes, we can now collect and process data of every mile driven over the last 2 years, or we can collect, process about nearly every cell in your body and all your lifestyle facts, how often you walk, run, or whatever. But how we then use that in an algorithm to say how likely are you to be sick or what would your expected cost of crashing the car is actually pretty ropey. So we've got all this data and we're using it to make some decisions, but actually the connection between all this and the decisions is actually quite ropey, because you can't really get insurance on the individual level. And I think these are the kinds of things that we should be pointing out. So, okay, you can have all this scan or whatever, but what does it really tell you about your life or your probability of death in each of the next so many years? I think very little. I think we're making some very wild assumptions between this data and the outcome. And we need to be hammering it home and maybe using that for public interest, that actually more collectivism is actually the better, the fairer way, and more in the public interest.
Yes, agree. I think the harder question is how do we actually do that? We've got another question over here.
I was thinking about what you've just been talking about, the public interest. And yes, it worries me that we might reach a point where we can accurately predict individual risk and price out a portion of the population. And that might be socially wrong. Does that mean maybe the profession should be starting a discussion about what data we should be using? Because if you're an insurance company, if you find a way of better quantifying the risk, you have a competitive advantage and you will use that. And that is the environment we're in. Maybe the profession should be talking about preventing that happening for social reasons. I mean, that goes against everything we do, but it's a question.
Yeah, I mean, currently, I mean, in life insurance, I mean, that kind of data is being tried to be done so that you can, there's a public benefit by making simpler, easier pre-approval or reducing the amount of questions you have to ask because you've managed to find the better risks. Currently, that's a very small number, so we're not in that problem yet because obviously you can only pick out with some certainty a very small proportion. As you move down that curve, I think we are right that we need to probably have a conversation of, well, when do we go from helping people by making the availability of insurance easier to then turn around and say, hold on, we've made it so much easier for this lot, there's a whole group here. And yeah, is there a point when we say we don't use it, or we should use it, or do we use something else to do it? Should it be the state that is the safety net? Is there more? Do we, in the new world of data, what does and doesn't work for what we've just done for the last 50 years?
From the insurer's point of view, what matters is that we're collecting the right premium for the population of policyholders. As long as we're overall collecting the right premium for all the policyholders, that's fine. It doesn't necessarily translate to being we're collecting the right premium for each individual policyholder.
True, but then again, the commerciality means that as soon as if someone's doing that and someone else refines, which is, you know, we've got the example of when people had, you know, aggregate rates and you moved to smoker, no smoker, smoker, non smoker, everyone moved to it. You know, no one's going to turn around and say it's a bit fairer to go back to aggregate because they'll be selected against like that. So it's, you know, we've seen that happen in a long time ago, and it probably took us a very long time to move to the massive change of smoker, non smoker. I think from what I've heard, it did take a long time for people to move to it, you know. We can't do, in this day and age, people change, they change their rating factors or their rates on their policies. People get picked off, everyone moves back again, and that's where we are now. I can only see it in getting worse or improving, depending on which way we're looking at.
Isn't this ultimately the difference between the commercial interests of the insurance companies in which a fair number of our members work and the public interest aspect of the profession, which should be advising, I suppose, the government and other informed parties on what they think is best in terms of insurers not being allowed to use data in the way you've described?
Yes. we have this embedded within us, don't we? Where we have that conflict. We have to take our commercial hat off to talk about one issue and then put it back on and actually work out the best way we can do for our employers when most of us are employed by risk carriers. I'll stop talking there.
Yeah, we've had a few questions on data. Is there anything else you want to say on data before we move on to another question that you guys may have for the panel members?
There's always things we could say. No, move on.
Okay. Any questions from the audience for the panel? Just generally on the... Oh, over there, John, on your right.
Hi, I have a question for Nick, especially. So I agree with your speech about the data manipulation shouldn't be done by actuaries. So I want to know your opinion about actuarial modeling work. So do you think this is also something that should be done by purely IT people? Or you actually need the actuarial knowledge to build a good model and maintain it? And do you also think the industry has paid enough attention to actuarial modeling functionality?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I was going to mention this as well. So I think given all the change we've done, especially with Solvency II coming in, the fact you have these specific models, they're nailed down, the experts have made them, everyone's supposed to know exactly what goes into them, the hundreds of pages of documentation. Theoretically, in a few years' time, all the hard work will have been done, unless they're all wrong, of course. But, you know, assuming they're right, you know, then all this hard work's been done. You will need some people who understand it. But I've had these conversations. I, as an actuarial student, found that it was not my skill set to be changing models and changing the code. And I know people who aren't actuaries who could do it a hell of a lot better than me every time with a lot less mistakes. So I think, and as I've seen experience, you have teams in your in the modelling team who've made it. You will have people who are not actuaries who actually know how to change the code and do the bits. I think over time you'll probably need less actuaries in there, because we've spent all this time, money and effort saying we're now happy with this model. We know what's in it. We've got parameters, so you don't change the code. Only a certain number of people can go in and do it. So by definition, we are reducing those coders. And do you need an actuarial mindset? Well, yes, some people will need to know whether it looks right or not, just making a change. But probably not as many as we've had. And I think it will continue down. So what are they going to do in time, these big valuation teams? Do they shrink?
Another question on your right over there, John.
Okay, sorry, can I have a follow-up question? So, I think if the model is well set up, you probably don't need so many actuaries, but regulation is changing consistently. Like a few years ago, we implemented like StormC2. That requires huge change to all the actuary models. And we just implemented that. We are now going through the IFRS 17. So, do you think this will impact the need for actuarial modelling?
Oh no, I think we could make enough regulation to keep the 20,000 actuaries in work for the rest of our lives, to be honest. And if we look back on it, I think we've been, let's be honest, we've done incredibly well at making ways for actuaries to be well paid from one event after another. So we missold pensions for a few years, we missold PPI, and I've got a massive list over here of stuff that we can keep going until we're all retired. That's one of them. Let's just make some regulation, take 20 years to put it in, then have a good idea to change it slightly. And then you have to show another 156 pages of documentation to prove what you just changed. So, yeah.
Hi. Just following up on the comment that you made about the fact that you think that we will need less modellers that are actuaries in the future. I'm also a student, by the way, so vying for a slice of that champagne. It's interesting you say that, because the one of the big things about Curriculum 19, 2019, was the introduction of Learning R, which is presumably to get more actuaries competent in programming. So do you think that the Institute is going in the wrong direction there?
We can open up to the council members, can't we, for that one?
Do you want to go first, Hilary?
Final questions, then we'll come back to final with us.
You're looking for the big fireworks at the end.
Yeah. I think let's write that question down to come back to it, because I do think it's a really good question. So you're definitely in for, you know, a possible prize. We've got another question over there.
Andrew Hammercott Fellow. Just to answer the question on why R is being pushed, that's a key part of data science. So you need to know R and Python, and between the two of those, then that gets you on the ladder of becoming a data scientist. So that's why it's in.
Interesting. Comment over there.
Hi, hand up. I'm a student as well. I don't actually have a comment. I was going to ask a question. Should I wait? So you talk a lot about UK versus overseas actuaries. So the new student actuaries coming in, those are currently students. Should we be looking at overseas markets as our potential future employment areas, and where or what type of areas other than the UK?
Good. Any other questions? We'll take one more question before we go to the panel. We've got one over there. Yep.
Stephen Floyd, a fellow as well. There seems to be a little bit of fear about data science, and I wasn't in the profession sort of 30 years ago, but I just wonder whether people were having the same debates about, you know, should we move from calculators to computers and stuff like that, and that I'm sure we probably were, and sort of moving, you know, personally, I love spreadsheets. I think I'll be using them for the rest of my career. But I think it's a good thing to embrace things like R and Python. And there's probably loads of things that you might study it and then suddenly realize there's something you can do that you didn't think of before. And I think it's just a natural progression just to learn as many of these data science concepts as possible, really.
Thank you. On that note, I'll quickly hand it over to the panel to give some thoughts, I think, mainly covering data science and the new curriculum and overseas markets question over there. Hilary, we can start with you.
Yeah, shall I start? So I'm going to start with saying some good things and then say some maybe a bit more critical things. So in terms of what the IFOA is doing, I would argue that some of the questions around how do we still make sure that we are acting in the public interest and particularly in wider fields, I would argue that lots of the changes that you've seen recently, things like the revision of the actuaries code, revisions of technical actuarial standards in which we have some input, the whole discussion around the chartered actuary qualification, the revision of the educational curriculum, and overseas markets. So about half our members are overseas these days, in case people have not kept up with that. You know, I would say that a lot of the work that the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries is doing in all those areas is meant to allow the same standard of acting in the public interest and the same standard of professionalism. Remember, we are a profession that regulates itself, so it's in all our interest to make sure that all our members act professionally and responsibly. And I think that a lot of the work that's been done in all those areas is meant to make sure that those same standards can be applied to areas where we have not traditionally been. And I think that's a good thing. On the question of, you know, should actuaries get back in their box and just carry on doing what they always did and stop being obsessed with wider fields, I think, you know, if we do think that, I think we're looking at an even smaller number than 1,000. The number of statutory roles is much lower than it was. Pension schemes, insurance companies, everything else is much bigger and doesn't need the same number of statutory roles as we did when we had a much more fragmented market. So I think, you know, if we do think that, then I think, you know, that is a very small profession, and I'm not really sure that it will be capable of self-regulating or of self-financing in the longer term. So, you know, I think it is important to look at those wider areas, and I think a lot of good work is being done. So that's the kind of good thing. The thing maybe I would be a bit critical of is not around those kind of issues, but around some of the points that have been made around how do we debate the crunch issues in our profession? So, you know, we've had one today, and there are a myriad of these, but this question of, you know, how individual should insurance be? Now, that's a debate that we are not having as a profession, because actually the IFOA has no structure where we can debate those things. So a lot of the work on those kind of things is done in practice boards, and I would argue practice boards are largely staffed by people who know each other and think the same things. And there's not adequate challenge brought to those practice boards. And it seems to me that there is really room within the profession for us to have something like an annual conference where we don't go for CPD, we actually go as part of a public interest role to have a public debate, a debate in public between ourselves about lots of these issues. And it seems to me that, you know, if you look at any other organisation, there are structures like that. And that's a real missing link, I think, for us as a profession. And the fact that we don't have that internal debate means, I think, that we're not very good at what Michael said we should be doing, which I agree with, which is to be leading a public debate. Because what I would say about experts is, you know, experts don't tell you the answers. Experts inform the debate. And the decisions are almost always political ones, which, you know, experts are no better qualified to answer than the man on the Clapham omnibus, or even the woman on the Clapham omnibus. And I think, you know, we need to work much harder at doing that thing of debating ourselves and informing public debate.
Thanks, Hilary. Michael?
Maybe tackle the UK global question, because that is another one that there are definite different schools of thought on. From a personal point of view, I guess you start from saying, do actuaries really add value? And I guess that's a balance internally between arrogance and self-esteem. And we're all different people, aren't we? So where one person's arrogance ends, another person's self-esteem starts, or whatever the phrase might be. But if we for the moment accept the hypothesis that actually actuaries do add value, and in particular, members of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries, because of our exam system, because of our professionalism, because of the infrastructure, are probably as good as anybody in the world. Discuss, you know, Society of Actuaries might, if they were here, might take a different view. But if we really believe in ourselves, then why should we not be thinking globally? Why should we not be thinking about how we help the world? Now, that doesn't mean necessarily world domination. There are different ways, and you can have partnerships and so on. I would start from that position, that there is something to be done globally where we really can help society as a whole. So it's public interest in the broadest sense. Now, that doesn't... I know that you get arguments then about, so you're going to omit the UK, or we're not going to give the UK enough thought because it's specific. And I suppose the picture has to be, if you think like that, you've got to find a way of adapting the principles and the practice of what we stand for to different countries. So there are, you know, somehow and there's a whole bit of work there to be done, you know, and I'd certainly, Hilary, agree with you that there are many missing links, aren't there? But for better or worse, I would think there are arguments for being a global profession. We're not getting it perfect, and maybe we're doing things for the wrong reasons sometimes, but we are there, and we do certainly interface, I think, very well and very influentially with the leading other actuarial bodies around the world. And I would personally think that that's really important for us going forwards. Just very quickly, I mean, I when we're talking about data, there's quite a bit of work being done on data ethics, and whether it's Microsoft's view on data ethics or what's emerging from the Royal Statistical Society and ourselves, you know, you can see a path where actually what will happen is those good principles will suddenly become guidance, and guidance may become regulation. And is that a good or a bad thing? There are very, very strongly held views on both sides of that fence. The people that believe in regulation and self-regulation would say proportionality is in the words, you know, and we don't make enough use of proportionality. On the other hand, I know you go through angst moments when somebody says, but Michael, you've not done that professionally. And you go, well, I've certainly not deliberately done it unprofessionally. Once you start to probe things with the benefit of hindsight, it becomes really, really difficult. But somehow or other, we need... Personally, I think I would see a world where, there's more rigorous self-regulation for people doing a public role somehow or other, whatever that means. The idea of reserve roles and so on may be in a slightly different space to the real commercial value adding. But I do understand that there are different views on that, and we need to find a way through that. And that's the sort of thing where we do need that public discussion, I think, Hilary, you know, and try and really help us reach a point where we all understand each other and so on. And I think the one thing I was slightly disappointed this evening, if I'm honest, is I haven't heard anybody say, you know, in 5 years' time, actuaries will be doing this, or in 10 years' time, actuaries will be doing that. That's the sort of thing where we need that imagineering to help us all. You know, we won't get the answer right, but it will give people on council, people that really care for the profession, insights into what people really think. You know, I come from a school of thought that says, as with the first bit, assuming it's self-esteem and belief for the right reasons that we can add value and not arrogance, actually it's a good thing the profession is bigger, and there is more we can do by being bigger, and we can help more people. But I can understand the other side. Again, it's one of those debating points, and if we believe actuaries can add value by helping Google, by, you know, the fourth industrial revolution is about bringing together neuroscience, medical science, and computers. You know, that must be something we can do in that space. I'm wittering on, so I'll shut up at that point.
Thanks, Michael. I think that was really useful. Nick, have you got a few closing comments?
I was just going to say, linked to the point about the public debate, I just think the best thing to do if you've got an opinion in the short term until there is another bit, volunteer for something that you see that's out there. If there's a working party or there's a board or someone you go, do you know what? No one's talking about this, or they may be, but I'd like to know it. Do something about it. I mean, you know, if I hadn't got drunk and agreed to join an organising committee for a conference 10 years ago, I may not be sitting here now. But, you know, there's a route to everything. You know, you do that conversation, you say, no, I'll do that. And you go, I enjoyed that. And then a bit later on, you get the next bit and you go, oh, yeah, I will do that one. And tell you what, that sounds interesting. And then you start in the conversation saying, can we just, actually, we would perhaps have just minuted that. Can we have half an hour to talk about that, please? And it's then the issues come out, but you won't have them unless you make the first step of saying, do you know what, it does sound interesting, let's go and have a chat. That was, I was told, for 50 quid, wasn't it? To put that in at the end? Was that not professional?
We can talk about that afterwards, okay, at the bar. So thank you, guys. I think that was a really good contribution from you all. And there are still some questions that are still unanswered and some questions that we struggle to understand, okay, but how can we actually action these questions? Our panel will be outside at the sandwiches and drinks, so please do, you know, go share any further thoughts you may have with them there. So thank you for your contribution. I've not forgotten about that. So for the two bottles of champagne, you know what I really liked? I really liked you talking about the bottle of champagne and asking for the bottle of champagne. Because you know what? I think we should do that more in our roles, where we ask to be put forward for certain kind of projects, whether it be in the actuarial fields or wider fields, because that's how we, you know, learn more. So one bottle of Moët for you. Do come fetch it afterwards. And then the other one for this gentleman in the middle over here. I know the face, but I've forgotten the name.
David.
Yep, David. So do come fetch it afterwards. Well done, both. And then if you do have time, do complete the online survey, which will go out to you afterwards, and networking drinks, do attend them. And thank you very, very much for the panel of speakers tonight. You've all been really good, and hopefully also for people.
Has been assigned Operation Win the Pitch.